Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time that people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 6, February 7th, 2011. Foreclosure crisis will worsen. Financial expert says don't expect recovery of housing market, by Pat Shannon. A recent Morgan Stanley Finance report cited by financial analyst Jeff Adams warns that a huge shadow inventory of homes with delinquent mortgages, which has yet to move through the foreclosure process, would take 47 months to clear at the current market sales rate. While realtors and bankers claim, or at least want the American people to believe, that the real estate market is turning around, Adams reports that Americans are not being told of this shadow inventory amid the rising tide of residential foreclosures that continues to paralyze prices and hamper housing market recovery. It appears this second foreclosure wave is about to arrive. More than 10% of all mortgage borrowers in the U.S. are seriously delinquent, and the shadow inventory riding that new tidal wave totals around 8 million. While there are no exact numbers on the extent of the nation's growing shadow inventory, Morgan Stanley is telling its investors to slow down and not jump too soon, Adams adds. People in Florida and California particularly have watched helplessly as the real estate crisis has pushed their home values to as little as 25% of what they paid for them less than a decade ago. The report continued, given the sheer number of potential homes for sale and the weak pace at which demand is trending, the bottom of the housing market may last another 3 to 4 years, during which annual appreciation may reach only as high as inflation or income growth, meaning real asset values will remain unchanged or lower throughout this period. The shadow inventory includes all loans behind by 90 days or more, already in foreclosure, as well as a large majority of loans that are 30 to 60 days delinquent and about to be in foreclosure. Morgan Stanley even includes a portion of current loans expected to eventually default. Considering that, as of March 2010, approximately 7.5 million, or 15% of borrowers, had fallen behind, with the above-mentioned 8 million still to come, the bankers and realtors have not even reached halftime in the predatory economic game. It takes place on a rigged playing field ultimately run by the shadowy private central bankers and their cohorts in commercial banking, wielding their debt-based monetary and crooked financial system against the middle class. Adams noted that firms besides Morgan Stanley are trying to measure the shadow inventory. Barclays Capital predicted that it would peak at 4.7 million in the summer of 2010. Capital Economics, a research firm, predicts that the shadow inventory could reach 5.5 million by the end of 2011. Thousands of people remain in their homes after banks have attempted to foreclose on them because many banks do not have original titles on the homes due to the bundling and securitization of mortgages. Page 2. Personal from the editor. A major central mission of AFP, as should be the case for all serious newspapers but isn't, is to point out the abuses of power and various injustices carried out by people who possess too much unchecked authority. Yet, scanning the horizon for ominous problems also means looking for solutions. My contacts alerted me that right now is a pivotal time to throw plenty of cold water on the bureaucrats who are in league with corporate profiteers, injecting fluoride into public water, since it is too toxic to dump in landfills. Turn to page 13 and check out the political scene in two major cities, Austin and San Diego, to get the latest in this brutal battle against involuntary mass medication. Thanks to AFP subscriber Arlen Shire of San Diego for his valuable input on this matter. The fluoride article is teamed with two other interesting pieces on page 12 by Dave Gahary and Frank Whalen to further show how much health is married to politics. We fuss over Obamacare as a nation, but self-care to prevent a serious health breakdown is the key. All insurance, public and private, contains booby traps that cost major dollars. On page 6, we present new information and valuable perspective on our economic troubles combined with insights toward solutions. This includes an Ellen Brown guest piece on more states looking at starting their own banks to avoid financial oblivion, and Victor Thorne's piece interviewing a noted speaker on monetary reform at Freedom Law School's upcoming annual conference. See more details on Payman's rally on page 15. In other matters, it's amazing that former White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel left the White House, moseyed over to Chicago to run for mayor, and got his name bumped off the ballot via a recent appeals court decision, only to have his name restored to the ballot within a day or so. Looking deeper, however, we at AFP wonder about the real story. Did Obama actually get rid of Emanuel? Running for mayor is a good cover story, but did Obama consider Emanuel, an arch-Zionist who served in the Israeli military, to be a troubling insider who appeared to be too closely watching Obama on behalf of Israeli interests? This matter reeks of intrigue. Notably, we regret the printing press error in AFP number 5, dated January 31st, in which page 17 was printed twice and page 18 was omitted. On page 22 in this week's edition, we are reprinting the columns by Vince Ryan and Jim Trafficant that were missed due to our printer's error. And we've expanded this issue to 24 pages as well. Mark Anderson. Google targeted for ties to CIA. The respected advocacy group Consumer Watchdog is calling on Congress to initiate a probe into the secret relationship between Internet giant Google and the National Security Agency, NSA, and the CIA. As part of a 32-page report, Consumer Watchdog blasted Google for its relationship with the U.S. National Security Agency and called for the company to be more open about what consumer information it shares with the spy agency. Last year, AFP reporter Ralph Forbes documented Google's close ties to U.S. spy agencies like the CIA and the NSA, as well as Israeli intelligence in multiple articles in AFP's September 13, 2010 and November 1, 2010 editions. All about connections. Former White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel was suddenly allowed back on the February 22nd ballot for the Chicago mayoral race within a New York minute of a three-member all-Democrat appeals court declaring him ineligible to run due to a residency requirement that he must have lived in Chicago for at least 1 year prior to filing. Emanuel raised more than $1.4 million in the final 10 days of 2010, and about $1.2 million of that haul violates the new state law limiting campaign contributions if the donations had been made after the first of the year, the Chicago Tribune said. Weapons of gas destruction. Life for the soldiers occupying Afghanistan is certainly no picnic. However, recent news of an open-air raw sewage lagoon that is the size of a lake, smack dab in the middle of the Air Force Base in Kandahar, has made a tough life even more unbearable for the 20,000 men and women stationed there. A New York Times reporter asked a passing airman, "Do you ever get used to the smell?" His response, "Never, not for a second." Ventura smacks down TSA. Former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura is suing the Transportation Security Administration over its unconstitutional invasive security procedures at airports across the U.S. Absent reasonable grounds for suspicion, Ventura's suit states, whole body imaging scans and pat-down body searches are unwarranted and unreasonable intrusions on Ventura's privacy and dignity and his right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. Can't stop terrorism. The recent suicide bombing in Moscow's busiest airport that killed more than 30 people demonstrates the impossibility of stopping terrorism, even after rolling out Rapiscan porno scanners and full-body pat-downs. With their million-man armies and their hundreds of billions of dollars in security spending, the U.S. and Russia are still incapable of stopping a small, ragtag army of dedicated Arab revolutionaries who will shell out a minimal amount of money to fight for the liberation of their region, to say nothing of the possibility of inside operations to blame on dissidents to justify even more crackdowns and controls. Chop shop for China. Communist China has reportedly built and tested its own stealth fighter jet, which experts believe is based on an American plane shot down over Serbia during NATO's aggressive war against the country in 1999. Jane's Defense Weekly reported that the U.S. Air Force had bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in an effort to stop China from getting hold of the technology. But it was too late. Local Serb farmers dismantled the U.S. plane and sold the parts to Russian and Chinese officials. Want to join the party? As more and more Americans lose their jobs and struggle to feed themselves and pay their mortgages, global bankers and top CEOs were on a wild spending spree in Davos, Switzerland, for the annual World Economic Forum. According to a New York newspaper, the basic membership at Davos plus the cost of a ticket to the event goes for $71,000, not including hotel fare, food, and a plane ticket. If you want to get beyond the velvet rope and attend several private meetings with some of the top bankers, it's $156,000. If you want to take five people with you to the event, that's going to cost you $622,000. Cruel but not so unusual punishment. The solitary confinement being inflicted upon PFC Bradley Manning, whistleblower on U.S. military operations being held in the Quantico, Virginia brig, is no exceptional torture devised exclusively for him. Across the length and breadth of the great American prison state, the world's largest with its 2.4 million captives stuffed into 5,000 overcrowded lockups, some 25,000 other inmates are suffering a like fate of sadistic isolation in so-called supermax prisons, where they are being systematically reduced to veritable human vegetables, reports Sherwood Ross, a media consultant for the Massachusetts School of Law. To destroy Manning as a human being, the Pentagon for the past 7 months has barred him from exercising in his cell, and to inhibit his sleep, denies him a pillow and sheet, and allows him only a scratchy blanket. Page 4, AFP on the State of America. Detroit's demise, a dire warning for other cities, by Keith Hansen. Detroit might not be the only city that sinks into bankruptcy this year if the economic storm that is prophesied to sweep across the nation lives up to its billing. Recent estimates place 48 states in an at-risk status, with Illinois the odds-on favorite to topple first. So it may be that the noble effort to save the Motor City has come too late. It's of little consequence, no doubt, that Detroit would be spared the ignominy of going down in history as the solitary failed city. Instead, it will be known as the first of many to have fallen. Presently, Detroit has suffered a 60% drop in factories and a nearly 90% reduction in its workforce from 1960 levels. The staggering impact of those numbers on the local economy doesn't take into consideration the loss of industry-related jobs and of secondary businesses that spring up around major employment facilities. What happened to the auto industry in 2009 could not have come as a surprise, given the kind of numbers floating around even as far back as 1993. At that time, a New York Times article entitled "Retirees Figure Big in Detroit Math" reported that in 1950, a company like Ford had 62 active workers per retiree. Just over 40 years later, the ratio had dwindled to 1.2 workers per retiree. As economic conditions continued to deteriorate and the wear and tear of the hits Detroit absorbed in the past began to show, both tangibly and psychologically, the toll manifested itself in several ways, the most marked of which is flight from the city. Since approaching 2 million in 1950, the population has steadily declined and now is at approximately 680,000, 82% of whom are black. Late last year, the Detroit News figured the official unemployment rate at 27%, the optimistic low end of a scale that in reality could easily be bumped upward to 47%. The city's infrastructure is in no better shape for this continuing depopulation, as certain low-income sections are targeted for the bulldozer. There are approximately 34,000 vacant homes, with three times as many vacant lots, and Detroit Mayor David Bing, a former National Basketball League player who spent 9 of his 12 seasons with the Detroit Pistons, projects that within 3 years, 10,000 homes will be razed, 3,000 of which will come down this year. Residents in the sections designated for demolition are offered buyouts and relocation. Although this plan on its face appears to be a radical move, several cities outside of Michigan have similar programs, with others ready to adopt such measures, an indication of how widespread and entrenched the nation's economic malaise has become. The median sale price for a Detroit home is now $5,800. That figure doesn't leave much for the city in terms of property taxes, which in turn isn't good for the school system that is over $100 million in debt and trying to stave off bankruptcy by possibly closing half its schools and increasing class sizes to 60 or more. Things have gotten so bad that a councilman with mayoral aspirations has abandoned his home. Detroit is also faced with a budget deficit of at least $85 million, moving Bing to plan more emergency measures such as halting key services to include fire and police, in parts of the city considered unsustainable. This move could also become an inducement to move people who are not inclined to do so, perhaps forcibly. Bing is also hoping for $25 million in aid from federal and state funds to pay for the first 2 years of demolition. Page 6, AFP on the banking industry. Activist touts state-run banks by Victor Thorne. Last May, author and filmmaker William Still stood on the floor of Missouri's House of Representatives and explained to legislators how they could cut their deficits in half by simply creating state-chartered banks. Still directed and narrated two of the most influential documentaries in recent memory, The Money Masters and The Secret of Oz. He will also be a featured speaker at the annual Freedom Law School Conference in Ontario, California, February 18th to 21st. This AFP writer will attend to speak and cover the event. During a January 19th interview with this writer, Still described how a notable degree of monetary reform can be realistically achieved. The Bank of North Dakota is a state-chartered financial institution that has been in existence for 93 years. It's also no coincidence that last year, North Dakota was the only state without a deficit. The reason why is that state-chartered banks work, and every state should be looking to North Dakota as a model, Still said, echoing an AFP article that appeared on the front page of the January 17th edition. Better yet, Still is certain that once momentum gathers behind this plan, our nation as a whole could escape the money trust's clutches. If only one state followed North Dakota's lead, it wouldn't be long before all the dominoes began to fall. Soon, other congressmen and candidates would be calling for their own state-chartered banks, Still confidently stated. When asked about the Federal Reserve's opposition to such a radical shift that would undoubtedly affect the Fed's profits, Still didn't seem fazed. If they could do something to prevent such a move, they would have already done it, he said. State-chartered banks preceded the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Plus, states don't need to ask for the Fed's permission. Under states' rights, they can't create money per se, but they can issue credit, and that's the key. Still boils his premise down to a few fundamentals. We need an interest-free form of money that is equally available to all people. Right now, the only ones controlling the amount of money that is created are big banks. The Fed is merely a pretext for these institutions, a wizard's curtain of sorts to make people think something is there. In actuality, every dollar in circulation is created as debt in the interest of bankers. They then rent this money to us, Still explained. Because money is created as an instrument of debt, major problems arise. Still pointed out that the U.S. is now paying $400 billion yearly in interest, and by 2020, these payments will increase logarithmically to exceed $1 trillion. While an array of possible solutions have been kicked around, Still address the limitations of some of them. For instance, he disagrees with the free market crowd for one specific reason. Free market concepts sound good in the context of laissez-faire capitalism, Still claims, except that they're not really free. On Wall Street, for example, four or five companies monopolize most of the high-frequency computer trading. He also does not view the new Tea Party Congress as a promising solution. As Still told AFP, as long as the federal government can borrow, it will. The temptation is too great. So, we need to eliminate the government's ability to borrow. He continued, if our Congress could regulate the quantity of new debt-free money that is issued without borrowing from the Fed, i.e. the big banks, we would be on the road to true fiscal responsibility. In terms of our current president, Still is not encouraged by Obama's knowledge. I don't think he has much understanding of these concepts, Still said uneasily. The people around him are erecting a deliberate smokescreen to confuse everybody. How bankers control America, the Money Masters video, how international bankers got control of America. Despite the warnings from his predecessors, Jefferson, Madison, Jackson, and Lincoln, in 1913 Woodrow Wilson, against his own better judgment, approved the Federal Reserve Act. How did all this come about? Who pushed for it? Who benefited the most? What secrets are being kept from the American people? Is there a way to get control of our money back from the bankers? DVD, 2.5 hours, $25. Order from AFP by calling 1-888-699-NEWS, toll free. Washington, Illinois, rally around state bank concept by Ellen Brown. Bills introduced on January 18th in both the House and Senate of the Washington State Legislature add Washington to the growing number of states now actively moving to create public banking facilities. North Dakota has been the long-established trendsetter in this regard, as AFP has chronicled. House Bill 1320 and Senate Bill 5238 propose creation of a Washington Investment Trust, WIT, to promote agriculture, education, community development, economic development, housing, and industry by using the resources of the people of Washington State within the state. Currently, all the state's funds are deposited with the private Bank of America. However, HB 1320 proposes that in the future, all state funds be deposited in the Washington Investment Trust and be guaranteed by the state and used to promote the common good and public benefit of all the people and their businesses within the state. The legislation is similar to that now being studied or proposed in several states, including Illinois, Virginia, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Maryland, Florida, Michigan, Oregon, California, and others. The effort in Washington State draws heavily on the success of the 92-year-old Bank of North Dakota, BND, currently the only statewide publicly owned bank in the United States. State budget deficits reaching crisis proportions was underscored in the January 19th New York Times, which noted that nearly everywhere, the fiscal crisis of states has grown more acute. Rainy day funds are drained, cities and towns have fired more than 200,000 people, and Arizona even has leased out its state office building. The reaction includes not only draconian cuts in services, tax increases, and the sale of public assets, but now includes bankruptcy filings. States are not currently allowed to go bankrupt, but a move is afoot in Congress to change all that. Bankruptcy proceedings would allow states to escape pension and other contractual obligations, following the dubious lead of such megacorporations as General Motors and Continental Airlines. Meanwhile, fears of state bankruptcy have caused state and municipal bond values to plummet and borrowing costs to soar. As with Greece and Ireland, rumors of bankruptcy became a self-fulfilling prophecy, bringing out the hedge funds and short sellers that turned prophecy into reality. Offering a beacon to follow, the Public Bank of North Dakota has been highly successful. It provides affordable, low-interest credit for business expansion, new businesses, and students. In the last 10 years, the BND has returned more than a third of $1 billion to the state's general fund. Unlike private banks, public banks like BND don't speculate or gamble on high-risk financial products. They don't pay outrageous salaries and bonuses to their management, who are salaried civil servants. The profits of the bank are all returned to the only shareholders, the people. Washington State Representative Bob Hasegawa called the proposal for a publicly owned bank a simple concept that will reap huge benefits for Washington. In a letter to constituents, he explained, "The concept is to keep taxpayers' money working here in Washington to build our economy. Currently, all tax revenues go into a concentration account held by the Bank of America, which makes money off our money." Page 7, Banks and Big Business. Kappa Beta Phi, A Secret Society for the Banksters, by Ralph Forbes. History's major trends are largely made by conspirators, even if we aren't taught that anymore. The Private Bank of England, the Federal Reserve Cabal, the Bilderberg Group, to name a few, have caused depressions, inflations, and world wars. In this context, let's inquire about Kappa Beta Phi, a secret honor society for leading Wall Street financial executives. Members include 1. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, the 10th richest man in America, with $18 billion in net worth, founder and majority owner of Bloomberg LP. 2. John Corzine, former CEO of Goldman Sachs, former U.S. Senator, New Jersey Governor, currently CEO of MF Global Inc. 3. Lawrence D. Fink, CEO of BlackRock, the largest money management firm in the world, controlling $12 trillion. With an array of government contracts, BlackRock is almost a shadow government. The modest Fink takes $22.7 million in annual compensation. 4. Richard Grasso, former head of the New York Stock Exchange, was forced to resign after it was revealed he was secretly given a payoff of $140 million. Grasso took the fifth against self-incrimination, and the New York courts ruled that not only could Grasso keep the $140 million, but he was entitled to another $48 million. 5. David Kamansky, former CEO of Merrill Lynch, now a director of BlackRock. 6. Sally Krawcheck, number 7 of the world's 100 most powerful women. 7. Kenneth Langone, former chair of the New York Stock Exchange Compensation Committee during the tenure of Grasso, an investment banker of the Home Depot. 8. Mary Shapiro, friend of Bernie Madoff, nominated by Obama as chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, confirmed by the Senate. 9. Diana Taylor, gal pal of Mayor Bloomberg, former New York State Superintendent of Banks. 10. Sanford Weill, former CEO of Citigroup, whose office holds a wood etching of him engraved with the words, "The Shatterer of Glass Steagall." Weill and partners ex-President Ford and Secretary of the Treasury Robert Rubin say they somehow knew that Congress would repeal Glass-Steagall, the antitrust firewall that kept banking out of insurance, and they profited to the tune of $76 billion, while the Glass-Steagall repeal helped cause the recent financial meltdown. And 11, John C. Whitehead, former chair of Goldman Sachs and Company, chairman of the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and former director of the New York Stock Exchange. He is associated with the Rockefellers. The Fraternity of Top Bankers was founded in 1929, just prior to the stock market crash. The organization is notoriously tight-lipped about what it does, but according to online resources, the group's purpose is to keep alive the spirit of the good old days of 1928 to 1929. Kappa Beta Phi isn't exactly fond of talking to the press. Once a reporter watched to see who would enter the Astor Suite, which costs about $1,050 per night, but when a messenger showed him his own photo from his Facebook page, this fearless journalist got the message and promptly left. The public record is shockingly vacant regarding information on such movers and shakers meeting in secret, much like the Bilderberg Group that has its annual world planning meetings behind closed doors with no inside attendance allowed by working reporters, although AFP every year makes whatever inroads it can to expose Bilderberg. The few press reports acknowledging Kappa Beta Phi's existence have been sweetheart stories. New inductees, only 15 or 20 top executives, are invited to join each year, sit at a long table with a black tablecloth at the front of the room. If our leading financial brains act like buffoons, that's outrageous enough. But if it's a Bilderberg clone that conducts workshops or other schemes of financial and political conquest of an undemocratic sort, then it's time to get out the pitchforks, tar, and feathers. Big Business, Police State, Want to Read Your Thoughts, by Keith Johnson. Sports car manufacturer Ferrari is currently working on a safety feature that monitors a driver's heart rate, blood pressure, respiration, perspiration, blink rate, facial reactions, and brain activity. This may sound like the ingredients of your last visit to the doctor's office, but for some journalists who have been covering this story, these things have all the makings of what's referred to as mind-reading technology. The two words mind-reading conjure up an array of scary images. We imagine ourselves being strapped to a chair and fitted with a headset full of electrodes. Meanwhile, a lab-coated technician shakes his head in disgust as he reads our innermost thoughts and desires being spelled out for him on an adjacent computer screen. Of course, this sounds Orwellian, but in reality, this kind of mind-reading technology does not exist, at least not yet. Ferrari's latest feature is no exception. The Italian company is merely repackaging existing medical instrumentation and cameras to measure physiological indices and body language. Even the so-called brain activity measurements do nothing more than monitor electric activity to certain regions of the brain associated with fatigue and alertness. Of course, this product could lead to some disturbing developments. For starters, it's not hard to imagine a lobbying effort on behalf of the manufacturers to compel Congress into making this feature mandatory for every new vehicle in America. A wireless interface could be added that would allow police to remotely tap into the database of a passing motorist. The officer could then analyze this information with his onboard computer to verify if it matches certain criteria, thus appearing to give the officer probable cause to stop the offending motorist. The U.S. government has also been guilty of misapplying the phrase mind-reading technology to some high-tech quackery it has rolled out in the ongoing war on terror. In 2008, the Department of Homeland Security unveiled its malintent system for identifying potential terrorists. It consists of a series of sensors and imagers that read, among other things, blood pressure, respiration, perspiration, blink rate, and facial features. Sound familiar? Aside from a few extra bells and whistles, The malintent system is not much different from Ferrari's new safety feature. In fact, both malintent and Ferrari focus on the same physiological indices that polygraph examiners have been measuring for decades. This writer has conducted thousands of polygraph examinations since 1984. As students, the first thing we learned from our instructors is that the words lie detector and machine are taboo. The tool of our trade is merely a medical instrument. It cannot detect lies any more than the malintent system can read minds. If a polygraph examination is performed correctly, it can help determine if a subject's reactions indicated deception. But this can only be established after comparing that subject's reactions to relevant questions against their reactions to control questions. This is an elaborate process that requires an extensive pre-examination interview. But even under ideal conditions, false positives can occur. The government's malintent system is not accurate at all, since it fails to employ any safeguards against false positives. General nervous tension can be easily misinterpreted outside of a formal testing environment. In the absence of control measures, there is no way to distinguish between a man who is nervous about cheating on his taxes and a man who is planning to hijack a plane. The best polygraph examiners rarely give examinations. They are able to convince the examinee that the test is foolproof and that it is in their best interests to come clean rather than come across looking like a liar. For talented interrogators, the polygraph instrument is merely a prop used to help elicit confessions. Page 8, AFP Spotlight on Congress. GOP offers its budget savers. A group of conservative Republicans in the House recently released a wish list of spending cuts, much to the delight of fiscal conservatives. The hope now is that Republican moderates, a euphemism for the neoconservative internationalists who dominate the Republican Party, will support the plan that calls for cutting spending by $100 billion. There really is no reason why the Republican leadership cannot get behind $100 billion in cuts to the federal budget. While $100 billion is certainly a huge amount of money to the average person, it's only 2.5% of the $3.8 trillion federal budget for fiscal year 2011. In order to really make a dent and cut spending by about 10%, Congress would have to jettison over $380 billion worth of programs. When pressed, most Americans can easily cut their spending by 10% or more in any given year. So why is it so hard for the government to do this? Prior to the November elections, House Speaker John Boehner, Republican Ohio, said he would push for at least $100 billion in cuts when Republicans take over the House. However, in a recent interview with a mainstream newspaper, Boehner said he's not sure he will be able to make that happen. He has now lowered the bar to about $50 billion. That's only a paltry 1% of the total budget, an embarrassment considering that federal deficits now run in the trillion-dollar range. There are many positives in the spending cut proposal that is being advanced by the Republican Study Committee, a conservative House Republican caucus. Few federal programs will be spared the knife. Programs hit the hardest include the Department of Energy, Homeland Security, Transportation, Housing, Education, Legal Services, and, best of all, foreign aid. The plan also gets taxpayers out of the home mortgage business by eliminating federal control of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This alone is expected to save taxpayers an estimated $30 billion over the next decade. In addition, Republican conservatives want to completely eliminate funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, as well as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Forcing taxpayers to fund paintings in Sesame Street is ridiculous when unemployment is topping 20% across the country. This would save taxpayers more than $500 million, or $445 million and $167.5 million in cuts, respectively. See the sidebar on this page for a list of specific cuts put forth by the Republicans. And don't forget to inform your congressman that fellow legislators have put forth a plan to help this country save money and get the national debt back under control. Key cuts could save taxpayers big money. The Republican Study Committee released its list of proposed cuts. The following is a portion of that list, including some of the top savings for taxpayers. Save America's Treasures Program, which hands out taxpayers' money to cities and towns to preserve landmarks, $25 million annual savings. International Fund for Ireland, which gives $17 million a year in aid to an organization promoting Ireland. Legal Services Corporation, which provides legal assistance to the poor in civil cases, $420 million annual savings. National Endowment for the Humanities, a federal program to promote language, philosophy, religion, etc., $167.5 million in annual savings. HOPE 6 program, which hands out taxpayer money to promote public housing in cities, $250 million in annual savings. Amtrak subsidies, $1.56 billion in annual savings. Eliminate education programs, H.R. 2274 in last Congress, authored by Representative McKean, eliminates 68 programs at a savings of $1.3 billion annually. U.S. Trade Development Agency, which gives out taxpayers' money to promote industry in developing countries, $55 million annual savings. Woodrow Wilson Center subsidy, taxpayers' money given to prop up this organization that promotes globalist thought, $20 million in annual savings. Cut in half funding for congressional printing and binding, $47 million in annual savings. Cut federal travel budget in half, $7.5 billion in annual savings. Trim federal vehicle budget by 20%, $600 million in annual savings. Essential air service, $150 million in annual savings. Department of Energy grants to states for weatherization, $530 million in annual savings. Beach replenishment, $95 million in annual savings. Exchange programs for Alaska Natives, Native Hawaiians, and their historical trading partners in Massachusetts, $9 million in annual savings. Intercity and high-speed rail grants, $2.5 billion annual savings. Title 10 Family Planning, which gives out free birth control or family planning to low-income Americans, $318 million in annual savings. Programs under the National and Community Services Act, $1.15 billion in annual savings. Applied research at Department of Energy, $1.27 billion in annual savings. Energy Star program, which gives tax incentives to companies that make energy-efficient products, $52 million in annual savings. Economic assistance to Egypt, $250 million a year. U.S. Agency for International Development, the federal agency that purportedly helps poor countries but is often used by Washington to keep countries in line, $1.39 billion in annual savings. General assistance to the District of Columbia, $210 million in annual savings. Subsidy for Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, $150 million in annual savings. IRS direct deposit. Require the IRS to deposit fees for some services it offers, such as processing payment plans for taxpayers to the Treasury instead of allowing it to remain as part of its budget, $1.8 billion savings over 10 years. Require collection of unpaid taxes by federal employees, $1 billion total savings. Prohibit taxpayer-funded union activities by federal employees, $1.2 billion savings over 10 years. Sell excess federal properties the government does not make use of, $15 billion total savings. Eliminate taxpayer subsidies to the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, $12.5 million in annual savings. U.S. Department of Agriculture Sugar Program subsidy, $14 million in annual savings. Subsidy to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, $93 million annual savings. Eliminate the National Organic Certification Cost Share Program, which helps farmers pay to be certified organic, $56.2 million in annual savings. Eliminate Fund for Obamacare Administrative Costs, $900 million in savings. Ready to Learn TV Program, $27 million in savings. State bankruptcies. One of the major questions making the rounds in the mainstream media is whether a state or a city can declare bankruptcy and escape its debts. A former top Republican, however, says he believes a federal bill that creates a roadmap for states to declare bankruptcy is likely to be entered into Congress in the coming weeks. We're faced with the danger that the states are going to try to show up and say to Washington, "You have to give us money," Newt Gingrich recently told a national wire service. And I think we have an alternative that allows us to say no. AFP is providing an in-depth analysis of one city that has been especially hit hard, Detroit. Once a thriving, wealthy metropolis, the Motor City is now one of the worst examples of an American city. States need to know that taxpayers are not made out of money. One option is to simply walk away from the massive debts they have accrued over the years. A far better solution is offered in another article on page 6, which proposes creating state-run banks for the purpose of helping cash-strapped local economies. Page 10, Conspiracy Fact with Pat Shannon. Scott Fall, the Forgotten Victim in North Dakota Ambush Case, by Pat Shannon. Any AFP reader of much tenure knows that we have devoted more time and space to the federal injustices of the Gordon Kahl murder case than any other publication. But even AFP may have neglected certain details surrounding the outrageous judicial treatment of Scott Fall. While Fall was only part of the supporting cast in the Kahl case, he still received the same life sentence plus 15 years for double murder, as did his friend Uri Kahl, the son of the late Gordon Kahl. Yet neither Uri nor Fall killed anyone on that fateful day in 1983. Following the February 13th shootout with U.S. Marshals and local police, World War II veteran and Silver Star recipient Gordon Kahl, 63, scribbled the details on the back of a grocery bag, explaining that only he had shot the officers and that it had been in self-defense. He and Fall slept in a barn that night, and early the next morning he took Fall to a friend's farmhouse. As Gordon slipped away to Arkansas, Fall insisted that he be taken to turn himself in, never imagining that he would be hit with the false charge of killing two marshals. An ill-planned murder scheme formulated by the U.S. Marshals Service in Fargo, North Dakota, had backfired and would require more cover-up help from the judiciary and the news media than ever before. Chief U.S. Marshal Kenneth Muir's foolish plans and actions resulted in the unnecessary deaths of himself and a deputy and the wounding of four others, while disrupting the lives of dozens of people in multiple families. And no family could have reached a higher state of confusion than that of Shauna Fall, who was left on her own to raise five children, all under the age of 9 at the time. "I am just as much a widow as those marshals' wives," she told this writer in 2005. In prison for life, Scott is just as dead to his children as those in the cemetery. At his constant urging, she divorced him the year after his conviction. The former chief marshal and current deputy, Bud Warren, had warned Muir in the past to leave Kahl alone, and that the warrant was no longer valid. Muir had replied, "I will handle it my way." Although the prosecution claimed at trial that the marshals had had no idea of Kahl's whereabouts and citing him was a fluke, paperwork surfaced 2 decades later showing that Muir enlisted the aid of an undercover plant, Mike Phillips, to inform on the movements of Gordon and his family by infiltrating the group meetings Gordon was attending. From prison, Fall uncovered witnesses who would testify that in November 1982, 3 months prior to the ambush, Muir attempted to solicit Phillips to burglarize Gordon's home, but Phillips refused. On February 7, 1983, Muir called Phillips again to learn that Gordon, Uri, and Fall would have their next meeting in Medina on Sunday, February 13, 1983. Muir then inquired if the individuals were always armed. Phillips told him that they were. Muir then said to Phillips in a highly agitated manner, "Good," and informed Phillips that he would be in Medina on February 13th and would kill the 3 armed named persons, making it look like a shootout. It was later discovered that the government, after the shootout, but before the May 1983 trial, had given Phillips $10,000 in cash to disappear into Canada, thereby ensuring that the defense could not reach him. Had the defense lawyers been able to subpoena Phillips, his testimony would have destroyed the government's contention that they had not known where Kahl was at the time, as well as proving that the ambush and attempted murder were staged by the federal officers, but Phillips could not be located to testify. Federal Judge Paul Benson, who had also presided over the questionable 1977 conviction of American Indian activist Leonard Peltier, refused to dismiss himself from the Kahl Fall trial bench, even though he had been in the same Masonic lodge with his brother in Freemasonry, Muir, and had even recommended him for the state's chief marshal position. There also was an undisclosed high school friendship between the jury foreman and the prosecutor, as well as suppressed information that Uri was interrogated while in a drug-induced state during his first night in an area hospital. In addition, the bullet that struck and damaged Uri's .45 caliber pistol when it was in his shoulder holster, which prevented the projectile from piercing his heart, was fired by Muir. This is what sparked the gunfight, but this evidence was not allowed to be presented in court. Frustrated at Gordon's initial escape, the authorities removed his son and Fall from society for a lifetime. A week later, FBI agents and marshals located Gordon in a farmhouse in Arkansas and fatally shot him through the back of the head without warning as he sat at a table. They then cut off Gordon's hands and feet. The elder Kahl, whose sin against the system was advising citizens that there was no law requiring them to file individual federal income tax returns, was forced to pay a head tax with his life. Page 12, breaking news. Delayed action biological weapons increasingly feminize world's men, by Frank Whalen. It's a blueprint being carried out in Japan to reduce its population, one whose success could very easily be implemented in America if a similar agenda continued to creep forward. On June 13, 2008, the New York Times reported on the passage of an anti-fat law in Japan, in which both men and women between the ages of 40 and 74 will be required to have their waistlines measured in an attempt to end obesity. Those found to be overweight will be given 3 months of dieting guidance, and after 6 months, they will receive further re-education. In America, we have a health care reform law yet to be fully implemented that could also require annual checkups to control weight. We often hear that being overweight is a disease and a drain on health care funds. It could also be taken to a different level involving young people. If children are consistently overweight, could that be construed as child abuse, resulting in children being taken into government custody? Increasingly, people are eating foods that contain added hormones to increase production. Since the early 1990s, cows have been given recombinant bovine growth hormone, a Monsanto Corporation innovation, to boost milk yields. Synthetic estrogen, given to both cows and chickens, increases the size of the animals and would clearly affect all resulting food products that humans consume. On July 30, 2007, the Kansas City Star reported on hormone fluctuation, causing males to experience gynecomastia, or enlarged breasts. As a result, some of these men have undergone breast reduction surgery. Considering the widespread use of genetically modified crops, it stands to reason that such things would affect the human body and even genetic structure. On October 27, 2005, the Russian Pravda news website reported on a study in which rats exclusively given genetically modified foods showed a severe and pronounced weakness in their offspring, resulting in a birth mortality rate of more than 55%. It seriously affected the behavior of the rats themselves, leading the Pravda reporter to conclude that genetically modified foods are, in fact, a delayed action biological weapon. Water would appear to be a factor as well. In 2006, the University of Colorado conducted a study to discover why fish were spontaneously changing gender. Studies have shown that estrogen taken in by women who use birth control is not properly filtered from wastewater during treatment of raw sewage and is subsequently released with high hormonal levels back into the water supply. In 2009, CNN reported that young Japanese men are now commonly referred to as herbivores, as they seem not interested in flesh, meaning they evidently are not interested in sexual relationships with women, preferring a more platonic situation. This mentality has resulted in lower birth rates and even translated into less economic production, as the aggressive business practices of previous generations have been replaced by a much more passive outlook. In Japan, masculinity is on the wane, being replaced by a more feminized male. America has experienced something similar. Commonly used term metrosexual was coined in 1994 to describe a straight male who displays an almost stereotypically homosexual obsession with looks, grooming, and clothing. The practice of men getting pedicures and their eyebrows waxed has become more common over the last few years. While these trends could be attributed to hormone overload, perhaps social engineering programs encouraging men to be more in touch with their sensitive side, communicated through the media and education systems, are a contributing factor. Other factors include long-standing internationalist concerns with planetary overcrowding and a perceived need to force the entire population into conforming with health regulations for the greater good. All these factors are on display in Japan, resulting in an easily palatable form of population control. Like other successful products sent to the United States by the Far East, it's not unreasonable to expect that similar programs have already been exported to America. Population, lack of arable land, spur food crisis, by Dave Gahary. The global food crisis is rearing its ugly head again, and unlike the most recent one in 2008, current crisis will not only remain, but will escalate in severity, including food riots spreading across the globe. An examination of 2010 crop price statistics says it all. Corn up 61%, wheat up 80%, sugar at a 30-year high, coffee futures up nearly 50%, cotton futures prices up 92%, and soybeans up more than 40%. A few weeks ago, the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, cut forecasts for U.S. crops, causing prices to climb even further. Even globalists have chimed in. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization's monthly food price index is at its highest level since 1990. And the World Economic Forum issued a warning that rising commodities might strain the world's food system. To get a better understanding of this current crisis, American Free Press spoke with Steve Mercer, Director of Communications for U.S. Wheat Associates, an organization that mediates between wheat producers and the USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service. AFP asked if the world is running out of harvestable land. Mercer was straightforward. Basically, there isn't any significant additional land to be cultivated. Since there is no more land in this sense, Mercer continued, farmers have entered into a struggle among themselves, a so-called fight for acres, between corn, soybeans, wheat, and canola. The price of each crop determines where farmers concentrate their energy. Mercer explained the quandary facing his industry. Over the last 30 years, the number of wheat acres has been steadily trending downward, he said. How much does population growth in the developing world contribute to this crisis? If you look long-term, Mercer said, global population is expected to reach 9 billion by 2050. The developing world will have the most influence on wheat consumption, since wheat tends to be a staple in underdeveloped countries. We feel that in the next 40 years, the world must produce 40% more wheat than it produces today. With all these factors impacting the price of crops, AFP asked about the possibility of this situation getting out of control within the next decade. Mercer was sanguine. Populations have certainly increased dramatically in the last 50 years, but productivity has also increased dramatically. Today, one U.S. farmer feeds 150 people. It used to be 20. So mechanization and the technology that's being put into seeds now have the potential to help us meet that demand. But it's not going to be easy. When we look at the future, we recognize that we have to produce more food with fewer resources, less water, and fewer pesticides. AFP inquired as to whether America might see a reclamation of urban land in the future, like what is happening in Detroit and across the country, a shift that should happen so more farmland becomes available. Mercer said, there's room for conventional farming, there's room for organic farming, and there's room for urban farming. It's my personal opinion that all of these things will be necessary in the future. Some folks are not waiting for the future to catch up with them. One Dutch scientist thinks insects will be the food of the future. In an interview with Reuters, he said that insects have more protein per cattle per bite, cost less to raise, consume less water, and don't have much of a carbon footprint. In a weird twist, the Dutch scientist, in order to make it easier to bite into that bug, plans to create a cookbook for the discriminating palate, of course. Page 13, Across the Nation with Mark Anderson. Fluoride battle intensifies in Texas, California, by Mark Anderson. Austin, Texas. The injection of fluoride into U.S. public water systems has long been alleged to be beneficial to human dental health, before the chemical compound finally was subjected to a growing wave of severe criticism. Now, after decades of being put into American public water systems, flowing through human bodies and onward through sewage systems, fluoride is reaching a dramatic tipping point. This is the time to bring fluoride's use to an end, according to a crusading scientist and activists in close touch with American Free Press. The imminent fluoridation of the municipal water in San Diego, California, for the first time in the city's history, and the difficult but sustained effort by Austin, Texas citizens to rid that city's water of fluoride, could have a huge bearing on whether fluoride keeps its seemingly secure place in public water supplies. Noted Cambridge and American-educated chemist Dr. Paul Connett, who spent 25 years in the waste management industry, said that Austin's situation represents a critical battle. Other sources contacted by AFP concur that if San Diego can resist or reverse fluoridation, and Austin can discontinue it, there could be a domino effect that may put America on the anti-fluoridation path on which Europe already is headed. Austin activists, if successful in defluoridating their city's water, would be able to proclaim Austin as the largest U.S. city ever to get rid of the dangerous additive, whose origins stem back to the Manhattan Project, where it was used in key processes to produce weapons-grade fissionable materials for the atomic bomb. A shift in the national paradigm came on January 7th when fluoride, still widely used in the U.S., was given perhaps its biggest ever public demotion by official sources in its approximately 60-year rocky history in American municipal water supplies. On that date, the mainstream press reported that the Department of Health and Human Services finally admitted that fluoride has harmful effects and that the dosage of it should be reduced in all U.S. public water. Activist Linda Green, a leader of the group Fluoride Free Austin, told AFP January 23rd in Austin that the report inspired her to intensify her activism. She referred to a noted 2006 National Research Council report that listed several harmful effects of fluoride. Problem, Green observed, is that the media only reported on brittle bones, including risk of fracture, brittle teeth, and stained, damaged teeth as being listed by the NRC as fluoride's ill effects. But the risk of cancer, thyroid problems, and several other ills, while included in the NRC's report, were not mentioned in most reports on January 7th. Zero fluoride is the only safe level, since fluoride also has been linked to a lower IQ in humans and animals, Connett noted. Dr. Neil Carman of the Sierra Club and San Diego dentist Dr. David Kennedy agree on the zero level. Connett last November approached the Austin City Council, but council members reportedly behaved arrogantly and failed to gather a quorum so its members could conduct official business. Connett, who addressed university students during the same visit, had to settle for meeting with council aides, who showed some interest and took notes. The water departments buy this hazardous waste, fluoride, that becomes a product, and they put it into our drinking water, Connett explained to that university audience, which was shocked that such a highly concentrated and exceedingly hazardous waste byproduct of certain manufacturing processes, aluminum, fertilizers, etc., suddenly loses its hazardous waste designation just because it's sold. Kennedy is among those working feverishly to try to stop the San Diego political machine from putting fluoride in the city's water, which at AFP's press time was slated to begin any time, amid allegations that some of the fluoride may come from Red China, a major manufacturing center. At city council meetings and other venues, Kennedy has met with numerous concerned citizens, including longtime resident Arlen Shire, a retired Air Force veteran who alerted AFP to the San Diego situation. The city's leaders have for decades been banned by law from spending tax dollars on fluoride, but found a loophole when a judge ruled that tobacco settlement funds could be tapped to purchase fluoride. Connett stated in a video presentation that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention admitted in 1999 that if fluoride has any benefit whatsoever, it is only topical, only for the surface of teeth. But why, he asked, do stores sell and towns inject fluoride into water used for baby formula when infants don't even have teeth yet? To get a tan, you don't drink suntan lotion, Shire Riley observed in a letter to AFP. Medicating the masses through water fluoridation is the ultimate violation of the right of informed consent that the American Medical Association upholds for doctors. Patients can only be advised of potential side effects and benefits, not be forced to take medicine. But state and local governments can legally do what doctors cannot do by pumping the poisonous fluoride into public water and forcing it upon the populace, thereby making it impossible to control the dosage. There are some crazy doctors out there that want to put lithium in water to reduce suicides and statin drugs to reduce heart problems, Connett added, praying that such insanity will never succeed. Federal agencies are taking public comments on fluoridation through February 14th. Call the Department of Health and Human Services at 202-205-0143 or toll free 1-877-696-6775. Page 14, Domestic News and Views. Arizona Moves to Stop Illegal Alien Voter Fraud by James P. Tucker, Jr. Resistance to President Obama's sellout of this country to illegal aliens is rising. Chris Kobach, Arizona's newly elected Secretary of State, a job he sought so he could fight voter fraud by illegal immigrants, has proposed legislation that he says will be head and shoulders above anything any state has ever done to secure the voting process. Kobach's election came at a professional cost. He will probably lose his tenured seat at the University of Missouri at Kansas City Law School because a leave of absence usually doesn't last 4 years, he said. Kobach's story echoes the strong resistance of many patriots. For election laws in Kansas and most states, if the secretary is not pushing for major reform to happen, then it isn't going to happen, Kobach said. It takes more than a few legislators. You really have to have a Secretary of State pushing for it, especially with legislation this groundbreaking. Kansas tried to enact a voter fraud bill in 2008, but then-Governor Kathleen Sebelius, Democrat, who later showed up at secretive international Bilderberg planning meetings without public knowledge, vetoed the measure. But in November, former Senator Sam Brownback, Republican of Kansas, was elected governor on a platform that included stopping illegal immigration and combating voter fraud. Thomas Witt, professor of the Kansas Equality Commission, has another problem with Kobach's plan. He said transgendered people may be rejected at the polls because their identification may not reflect their gender. Birth certificates do not reflect their gender, Witt said. I've already heard from transgendered people having a hard time because they haven't changed all their documents. Right there, you're having people being disenfranchised. Kobach has the law on his side. Indiana's voter fraud law, which requires voters to show an unexpired government-issued ID at the polls, was upheld by the Supreme Court in 2008, and again by the Indiana Supreme Court in June. Brandon Judd, president of Local 2544 of the National Border Control Council, said the recent murder of U.S. Border Patrol agent Brian A. Terry by illegal aliens, CAFP number 4, January 24, 2011, page 1, about 10 miles north of the border, was a result of Washington's softness. This is one more example of the sacrifices made by frontline agents, and it's a major reason we are continually outraged by activists and self-serving politicians with incessant talk about amnesty for illegal aliens, Judd said. While they play games, our country continues to be invaded, and Border Patrol agents continue to pay the price. Representative Lamar Smith, Republican Texas, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, said 28,000 people, including 1,000 law enforcement officers, have been killed in the past 5 years. Our border remains porous, and the Obama administration has done nothing to stop the steady flow of human and drug smuggling from Mexico, he said. Obama should be ashamed of his State of the Union, by Christopher J. Petherick. On January 25th, at a critical time in this great nation's history, President Barack Hussein Obama delivered his second State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress in Washington, D.C. Presidential addresses are often a time for cheerleading, promoting pet issues, and for inspiring nations. In 2002, following the September 11th attacks, President George W. Bush prepped the nation for a war against Iraq in his State of the Union address by accusing the Axis of Evil of targeting the West with their weapons of mass destruction, something we know now to be totally false. Today, the once great United States is facing unprecedented employment. Millions of people are losing their homes. More Americans than ever in U.S. history are on welfare. Good-paying jobs are still leaving this country at paces never before seen. The divide between the haves and have-nots is wider than ever. Contrast this with the federal government, which is living high on the hog as if the U.S. economy never missed a beat. More than half of our elected representatives now millionaires, and some of the wealthiest counties in the country bordering Washington. No one who's on the federal payroll has to worry about skipping a meal to make ends meet. And with the national debt topping $14 trillion, war spending continues to go up, along with foreign aid and pork. So what does Obama offer in his annual address to the nation? He congratulates Wall Street, the people behind the economic collapse, for roaring back, and applauds the fact that profits are up at multinational corporations, headed by greedy executives who are busily exporting Americans' jobs. But even worse, Obama, our great leader who was elected with the support of America's leading unions, takes a moment to laud the bevy of trade agreements his underlings negotiated with India, China, South Korea, Panama, and Colombia. To American workers, these trade agreements are hardly free or fair. They all come at a steep loss to Main Street, as jobs continue to leave our shores for slave labor in these third world countries. For anyone who could sit through all of Obama's platitudes and vague promises, the answer to America's economic troubles was sorely missed. Following the collapse of the stock market in 1929, Congress passed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which slapped levies on some 20,000 imported goods. For years, free traders and libertarians have smeared Smoot-Hawley, claiming it worsened the U.S. economic situation. But the truth is, following its passage, factory payrolls increased, and American construction and industry thrived. But that is only a part of the solution. Congress should move immediately to repudiate the national debt, to simply walk away from the international bankers who have profited far too long off American labor, and to start anew. Fighting terrorism in Yemen and allowing homosexuals to serve in the military does nothing to help those struggling to pay bills in the nation's heartland, the people who can make this country great again. Page 16, AFP Profile. Israel Senator, a Neocon at Heart, by Victor Thorne. On January 19th, one who can accurately be described as Israel's senator from Connecticut, Joseph Lieberman, announced that he will not seek re-election in 2012. As the first Orthodox Jew to serve in Congress, Lieberman lost his Democratic primary in 2006, only to miraculously achieve victory in the general election as an independent candidate. Strangely, in his 2000 senatorial race, Lieberman's GOP challenger received 448,077 votes. Likewise, in 2006, his Democratic foe received exactly the same number of votes, 448,077. The incredible odds against such a numerical match don't seem so bizarre when voters realize that Lieberman's campaign hired Prenzina Holloway, who was specifically barred from engaging in absentee ballot activities. Not surprisingly, one of Holloway's duties for Lieberman included voter outreach and the distribution of absentee ballot applications. The move elicited allegations of vote fraud. Close scrutiny of Lieberman's record over the past two decades reveals a man firmly entrenched in deceit, corruption, and strict opposition to personal freedoms for the American people. In addition to his support for increased surveillance spy cameras, Lieberman also proposed a Senate bill, S-3480, that provides a massive power grab to the president in times of national cyber emergencies. One aspect of his legislation is an internet kill switch that conceivably grants the White House the power to shut down the entire internet. Lieberman commented on this draconian measure. If China can disconnect the internet, we need to have that here, too. The senator's dictatorial nature also led him to co-sign the SHIELD Act last year, a move allowing online whistleblower organizations like WikiLeaks to be prosecuted under the Espionage Act. Similarly, along with Israel's second most favorite American senator, John McCain, Republican Arizona, Lieberman favors detaining individuals without release, even if the Department of Justice knowingly can never obtain guilty verdicts in a court of law. The McCain-Lieberman police state mentality also extends to authorizing CIA operatives to murder U.S. citizens on foreign soil, in addition to weakening whistleblower protections. Of course, it's no secret that Lieberman is an ardent Israel-first neoconservative warmonger who supported McCain's 2008 presidential bid. Over the years, Lieberman has called for military strikes against Iran and Yemen, causing Senator John Kerry, Democrat from Massachusetts, to refer to him as the new Cheney. On January 20th, Lieberman still insisted that the U.S. invasion of Iraq was justified and that there were weapons of mass destruction found in the Middle East country. He stated on MSNBC, "I believe that the evidence is very clear that Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction." Although George W. Bush has admitted that Iraq had no such weapons, Lieberman forwarded another grotesque lie, that Hussein was financing the same terrorists who attacked America on 9/11. Again, this propaganda was dispelled by a Senate Intelligence Committee report, finding no connection between Al-Qaeda and Hussein. Lieberman went on the record during a December 18, 2010 town hall meeting and claimed that he would not condone a new 9/11 investigation. He based this assessment on the inexplicable collapse of the World Trade Center 7 building, the third Manhattan building to crumble on September 11, 2001. Lieberman claimed, "I have no evidence that this really occurred." With mind-boggling audacity, Lieberman added, "The 9/11 Commission was totally bipartisan. They dug up everything. They were very critical of people in our government and our intelligence services." The extent of Lieberman's deception and treachery knows no bounds. He and his wife Hadassah, a high-powered lobbyist, collected over $1 million in campaign contributions from healthcare companies during his congressional tenure. As such, he became a strong advocate of Obama's health care bill, while also supporting disastrous cap-and-trade legislation. Israel's senator has also forged strong ties with Anti-Defamation League director Abraham Foxman and Christian Zionist pastor John Hagee. At a July 2007 Christians United for Israel rally in Washington, D.C., Lieberman said of the Texas-based Hagee, "He is a man of God, and like Moses, he is the leader of a mighty multitude." As a further example of his clout, Lieberman joined Zionist mouthpiece William Kristol in auditioning Alaska Governor Sarah Palin prior to her becoming McCain's vice presidential candidate in 2008. Earlier, Lieberman served as Al Gore's running mate in 2000, appropriately bowing under to the Florida vote scam debacle that allowed Israel's neoconservative cabal under George W. Bush to seize control of the White House and unleash its 9/11 false flag strikes against New York and Washington. Alan Rowland may have most effectively summarized Lieberman's reign of terror in a December 17, 2009 article entitled, Why Lieberman Rules the Senate. Rowland wrote, Joe Lieberman is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, Senate minder, like Rahm Emanuel is Obama's APAC minder. Joe Lieberman speaks for APAC and, in turn, is protected by APAC. Page 18, AFP on the Mideast. Mossad losing its reputation of invincibility, by Richard Walker. There was a time when the very mention of Mossad, Israel's premier spy agency, sent shivers through its friends and enemies alike. It had an almost mythical status, and its highly trained assassins were the stuff of Hollywood legend. Mossad agents, both men and women, would be parachuted into a country or would arrive on its coastline from a submarine or fishing trawler. Teams providing technical backup and other logistical support, including vehicles and escape routes, would already be in place. Kaidan, as the agency's assassins were known, would use guns, knives, chemical weapons, or secret means of assassination, which left few forensic traces. They even knew how to conceal a bomb in a target's phone and activate it with a phone call. Mossad's spies also had a legendary status. Some were sleeper agents for decades, living a lie in other communities and waiting for a phone call or coded letter to activate them. It has therefore come as a shock to the Israeli public and spy watchers across the globe that Mossad is showing signs it is no longer the invincible agency it was once cracked up to be. A former British intelligence officer, who spoke to American Free Press on condition of anonymity, felt Mossad had fallen into the trap of thinking it was so superior to its enemies that it did not need to worry about them. In this officer's view, it failed to recognize that Israel has fewer friends across the globe, and therefore the Mossad's mistakes, which might have been glossed over in the past, are now more likely to make headlines. Mossad was never going to maintain the level of success it once had because countries it targeted in the past have improved their intelligence and counterintelligence capabilities, he said. Mossad has taken on more tasks than it can handle with the assets available to it. There is a finite limit to the number of jobs any agency can handle because training agents for work in the field is a costly, time-consuming job, and top-class talent is limited. Few people realize that Israel's growing dependency on the CIA for running ops in the Middle East is a sign of Mossad's limitations, the former intelligence officer explained. The assassination of a Hamas leader in Dubai in 2010 was an operation the former intel officer singled out as an example of Mossad's decline. The 11-person hit team that carried out the Dubai killing was caught on camera and the agents' identities were compromised. So, too, was the way they operated, using fake passports and credit cards supplied by private American financial institutions. The operational base used for the hit was located in Europe, not Israel, but even some of the people who ran it are now known to the German authorities. The former British spy has this to say about the Dubai hit. It was a disaster, and it did a lot of damage to Mossad. Having those operatives on camera and later on an Interpol wanted list means their training was wasted. They are of no further value in the field. For that to happen was proof, if anybody needed it, that Mossad has become sloppy and overconfident. There is now evidence Mossad has recently been dealt an even bigger blow by the exposure of 10 of its spies in Iran, where it has been busy running a dirty war with the direct assistance of the CIA and U.S. Special Operations agencies. One element of this undercover war has been the targeted assassinations and abductions of Iranian scientists and other Iranian nuclear experts. Some of the Mossad CIA operatives used in Iran were trained at a joint Mossad CIA facility within an Israeli base close to Herzliya on the Mediterranean Sea coastline. The base is classified within CIA files as one of a number of U.S. military intelligence sites in Israel. The sites have numbers from 51 through 56. Most of the sites contain military and technical equipment to be used in the event of a war with Iran, but the one at Herzliya is also reserved for managing combined CIA and Mossad operations aimed at Iran. The Mossad and the CIA appear to have underestimated their Iranian counterparts because it took just 1 year for Iran's internal security apparatus to unmask the spy network, which Iran says was involved in killing one of its scientists. Among the spies seized was a young man who admitted he was trained by the Mossad in electronic surveillance and counter-surveillance, as well as in techniques for attaching bombs to cars. Israel did not deny Iran's claims about the spy network. In the past year, Iranian intelligence has also captured and executed leaders and senior fighters of the Jundala terror network, which has been used by America and Israel against Iran. See AFP Issue 1-2-2011 for more. Much to the displeasure of Mossad and the CIA, Pakistan has begun handing over Jundala fighters it has captured to the Iranian military as well. Page 21, AFP on the Mideast. Barbarous Bibi singing the same old song of war.
by Mark Glenn. Like some Johnny One Note, oblivious to the irritation he causes his listeners by droning on endlessly with the only tune he knows, Israel, personified by Prime Minister Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu, is again serenading countries around the world on their duty to fight each and every war demanded by the Israelis. In this case, Iran is in the crosshairs. Netanyahu made it crystal clear during a recent press conference that war is the only acceptable course of action to solve Iran and its nuclear program. Wagging a lecturing finger in the face of a reluctant, war-weary America and Uncle Sam's use of sanctions over smart bombs so far, Netanyahu underscored Israel's position by saying, "Only the convincing threat of military action heeded by the United States will persuade Iran to drop plans to build an atomic bomb." He also made it clear that regime change is in the works. Given the fact that Israel can only exist in an environment where all its neighbors are fractured, disoriented, and unable to coalesce around a singular idea or figure, the fact that a small man in Iran is able to thumb his nose at two of the world's superpowers, the U.S. and Israel, and get away with it poses more danger to Israel's continued existence than would 1,000 nuclear warheads, as Netanyahu sees it. Those following Israel's shtick over the years doubtless will notice the business-as-usual nature to the above demands. This is, after all, the same Israeli prime minister who gloated over the 9/11 terrorist attacks, saying they were, in a sense, good because they would generate immediate sympathy for Israel. Netanyahu has not missed an opportunity in playing the town crier regarding what a nuclearized Iran would mean for the world. It was Netanyahu and his fellow minstrels who stated in a 1990s policy paper, "A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm," that Israel's emergence as the sole superpower in the Middle East could only be accomplished through a series of devastating wars against its neighbors. Therefore, the notion that this broken record would continue playing its maddeningly repetitive chorus, demanding that ever more American treasure be expended in fighting Israel's wars, should be of no surprise to anyone with ears to hear. Given the fact that Israel successfully seduced the most powerful Gentile nation in the world into doing the Jewish state's dirty work, murdering innocent people en masse in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, why then would Israel's dear leader expect any less with regard to Iran? The problem for Israel, of course, is that interested parties in America, most notably the Obama administration and certain high-level military players, aren't tapping their toes with Netanyahu's latest war ditty, dealing with the ear-splitting economic cacophony of two overt conflicts organized and instigated by Israeli interests, has left America's ears ringing to the point where she is not listening. This brings what's left of the civilized world to the truly frightening point where all should ask, what's next? After all, a madman with a messianic complex who considers 3,000 American deaths on 9/11 acceptable in terms of Israel's interests is capable of doing anything to snare a captive audience, including, but not limited to, another false flag attack such as USS Liberty Part 2, or the smear or assassination of a president who does not applaud the singer in question. Indeed, as described in a 2001 report written by the U.S. Army School of Advanced Military Studies, Israel and its intelligence agency, the Mossad, are enough of a danger to American interests as to warrant an official description as thus. A 500-pound gorilla, wild card, ruthless and cunning, has capability to target U.S. forces and make it look like a Palestinian Arab act. What all of this means is that those longing for a little peace and quiet these days must react with justifiable concern whenever Israel and its band of war addicts appear publicly and begin beating the drums for more American involvement in the shedding of Middle East blood. For at the end of the day, while Israel sings, "Happy days are here again," American parents keep on burying their children to the sound of taps. Page 22, Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant. "Don't Support Policies That Breed Discontent, Despair," by Jim Trafficant. The recent tragedy in Arizona is another incident of abhorrent behavior occurring in our United States. One would think that these types of heinous acts would only occur in other lands, not America. However, America amasses many statistics relevant to mass murders that make some other countries look pretty good in comparison. Experts, various talking heads and analysts keep asking why about such incidents. But the truth is, if one were to honestly answer that question, they would be vilified and even made to look un-American. Freedom of speech, if we really have it, seems to only exist when one is saying something that already is acceptable to the powers that be. We've evolved to a system of personal freedom that is now limited by that which the government finds acceptable. I've said many times that no one is reading the dynamics that are beginning to boil over in America. There is much disenfranchisement. We are producing more and more people that keep venting their frustration through behaviors we can't comprehend. Our government is much to blame for these dynamics. The government's actions certainly do not excuse bad behavior, but they explain it to a point. Blowback from America's foreign policy has made terrorism into an American import, while America's domestic policies, especially the economic ones, have fermented into domestic despair. And those dynamics are not even being addressed by our policymakers. Woe to anyone who dares to truthfully assess these dynamics. For now, let's address another tragic moment in American history. One begins to wonder about the threats that may have existed, but were possibly dismissed. I recall my original involvement in the case of John Demjanjuk, the Cleveland, Ohio auto worker who was convicted and sentenced to death as the infamous Ivan the Terrible of the Treblinka, Poland concentration camp during World War II. One newspaper wrote this incendiary item: "Trafficant supports Nazi mass murderer." I guess you can picture the reaction by many people throughout America. I received impolite calls and heard remarks like "Nazi lover," "un-American congressman," with many of these responses containing veiled threats. Some demanded I be removed from Congress. Others said I should be hurt and punished. At that point, where could I get help? The federal government was doing everything possible to demean me. Press knew of the threats, but never mentioned them. I could have ended up being another victim of a lone nut taking out his frustrations. Where was my protection as a member of Congress? Because the Demjanjuk case was volatile, I was concerned that someone might attack me or my family. I took every possible precaution while never mentioning one time the dangerous position I was in because of headlines that were misleading and untrue. But when my investigation in tandem with the Demjanjuk family proved Demjanjuk's innocence and the Israeli Supreme Court released him, this same press never apologized for their attempts to smear me. In fact, they were content with their behavior. The issue for most Americans today is despair. There are many desperate people throughout America. What pushes them over the edge? These issues must be addressed. Brutal behavior will continue to happen. However, we all need to stop being part of the problem by tolerating known sources of widespread discontent, especially the nation's crazy economic policies. We all should wish the best for Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who sustained a serious injury in the January 8th Tucson shooting. And I say rest in peace to Judge Roll and the other victims who tragically join a long list of innocent Americans who have experienced this madness. Get back at me. The Ryan Report from Vince Ryan. Truth, the real victim of this Remembrance Day. By Vince Ryan. In 2005, the United Nations General Assembly designated January 27th as International Holocaust Remembrance Day to urge member nations to develop programs dedicated to remembrance and education in order to prevent future acts of genocide. It denounces Holocaust denial and deniers and condemns discrimination and violence based on religion and ethnicity. Under the lash of the Zionist lobby, there will be remembrance services and commemorative events from coast to coast. Among these is the remembrance program at Regent University in Virginia Beach. The chancellor of Regent is the very wealthy Pat Robertson, the 700 Club televangelist and promoter of close American ties with Israel. Like the corpulent con man, Reverend John Hagee, his advocacy of global Zionism is legend. In 2010, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum hosted a candlelighting ceremony attended by the Washington, D.C. Diplomatic Corps, alleged Holocaust survivors, and white liberals. It's not surprising that the UN rejects Holocaust denial. No ambitious academic or member of an establishment think tank would dare deny, critique, or propose an inquiry into the truth or falsity of the 6 million myth, a mishmash of lies, legends, and lagniappe worthy of the great Baron Munchausen. Any fair-minded person should be able to see that honest and open investigations and studies are the meat and potatoes of real academic scholarship. But no, the dogmatists who perpetuate and profit from Holocaust promotion will not permit any real inquiry. Their dogma is carved in stone, just like the Ten Commandments. What are they afraid of? Obviously, they are afraid of truth, what they must keep suppressed at all cost. Perhaps you have noticed that the Holocaust industry employs promoters to travel around selling the Holocaust to innocent elementary school children, and even participate in debates about the evils of Holocaust skepticism. The itinerant Holocaust promoter who speaks to your children may be an alleged Holocaust survivor, or he or she may persuade you and the children to visit a Holocaust museum. Thousands of children and their teachers, accompanied by the promoters, come to visit the museum in Washington, D.C. every year. The Holocaust promoters and their descendants have garnered billions of dollars in reparations from Germany, Austria, and the United States, and many others, not to mention valuable land in Palestine. Israel has grown from nothing into a nuclear superpower armed with at least 400 nuclear bombs and the rockets to fire them anywhere. The oppressed Jews have become the oppressor, while the United States and Germany pick up the annual tab, somewhere in the $12 billion range. And Israeli influence over the U.S. Congress is legendary. When the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee speaks, our senators and representatives listen and act accordingly if they want to keep their jobs. You may be wondering, where is the honest side of the story? Well, there are over 20 books on the Holocaust that are available from the Barnes Review Book Club. For the modest remittance of $5, you may purchase the Revisionist Book and Video Catalog from TBR, P.O. Box 15877, Washington, D.C. 20003.